Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, The Existence of God, Part 23. For more information and resources, go to reasonablefaith.org.
The ontological argument for the existence of God was originated by a Benedictine monk in the 11th century, St. Anselm, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury. Anselm had been working on arguments for the existence of God. He was a natural theologian, but he was frustrated because he wanted to find a single argument that would prove that God exists with all of God's superlative attributes. And he had nearly given up on this quest when he came upon the concept of God as the greatest conceivable being. God, he said, must be the greatest conceivable being, because if you could conceive of anything greater than God, then that would be God. So by definition, the concept of God is the concept of the greatest conceivable being. And Anselm believed that once a person came to truly understand this notion of a greatest conceivable being, then you would see that such a being must exist, that the existence of God follows from the very concept of God. And that's why Anselm believed the scriptures say that the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Because once you understand the concept of God, you will see that God must exist. And therefore, anyone who asserts that God does not exist is uttering a logically incoherent statement. Now, Anselm's argument came to be known as the ontological argument, from the Greek word ontos, which means being. And the thing that makes an ontological argument, is that the argument attempts to deduce the being or the existence of God from the very concept of God. Once you understand the concept of God, then you will see that God exists. Now, the argument has gone through a long history of revision and development, and the version that I want to share with you in this class is one that has been developed by a man who is widely regarded as the greatest living Christian philosopher, Alvin Plantinga. Now, in order to understand Plantinga's argument, it's helpful to have a little bit of philosophical background so as to grasp the argument. Plantinga's version of the argument appeals to the language of possible worlds. Now, what do we mean when we talk about possible worlds? Well, we're not talking about planets or even another universe. Rather, by a possible world, one simply means a sort of maximal description of reality. I think maybe the best way to think of a possible world is to think of it as a conjunction of true propositions. So let's imagine some propositions, P, Q, R, S, and so on. And these would be statements like David Sherrill teaches at Georgia Tech. Georgia Tech campus is in Atlanta. Ronnie Swindell attends Defenders class at Johnson Ferry Baptist Church. Just all of these various truths, these are various propositions. And you can imagine a possible world as just a huge conjunction of such propositions, P and Q and R and S, so that all of the propositions that are true are included in that conjunction. Now, we can alter some of these propositions by saying we can negate them and thereby arrive at a different world. So, for example, world one might be P and Q and R and S. World two would be, say, not P and Q and not R and S and so forth. And world number three could be not P and not Q and R and S and so forth. And world number four could be P and not Q and not R and not S and so forth. And each one of these will represent a different possible world. It's a maximal description of the way reality might be. So when we're talking about possible worlds, we're not talking about parallel universes or other sorts of worlds that exist populated with actual people and things. We're just talking about these abstract descriptions, maximal descriptions of the way reality might be. Now, since each one of these worlds has to be a possible world, that means that the propositions that make up the conjunction need to be able to be true together. Both they need to be able to be true individually, and they need to be able to be true conjunctively, together. So, for example, take a proposition like, the prime minister is a prime number. Well, that's not even possibly true. A prime minister couldn't be a prime number because a prime number is a sort of mathematical abstract object which couldn't fill the role of a prime minister. So that proposition will not be even possibly true. It's not a member of any description of reality. That proposition will be false in every possible world. It will be necessarily false that the prime minister is a prime number. So that proposition will be false in every possible world. Now, by contrast, take a proposition like Hillary Clinton is the president of the United States of America. Now, that proposition is not true, but it's possibly true. There is a possible description of reality in which Hillary Clinton is the president of the United States. So that proposition is true in some possible worlds. There are descriptions of reality in which that proposition is true. So to say that Hillary Clinton is the president of the United States in some possible world just means that there is a description of the way the world might be which includes that proposition in it, and that proposition is true. So, to say that God exists in some possible world is simply to say that the proposition that God exists is true in one of these possible worlds. To say that God exists in a possible world is simply to say that that proposition is true in one of these descriptions of reality. Now, is there any question at this point about what we mean by possible worlds? Yes, Cindy.
Okay, some would say God does not exist in this real and possible world that we live in. Then I guess I'm having a little bit of a difficulty to calculate that into
right.
What you're saying.
If a person says that God doesn't exist in the actual world, that's to say this proposition is false in the description that is the actual world. In other words, what Cindy's saying is, one of these worlds that we have mentioned here is the actual world. The actual world is a possible world, right? So let's call the actual world, say, alpha, and maybe this is the actual world here, W3. So W3 is the actual world. These other worlds are not actual. And in this world, the atheist is claiming the proposition God exists is false. Now, as theists, we disagree. We think that that proposition is true in the actual world, that God exists. But the atheist disagrees. He'll say that proposition is false in the actual world. Any other question about this language of possible worlds? Bob?
Yeah, I've thought about this argument for some time. And to me, it's about 99% question begging. I don't know. Maybe I just don't have that.
Well, now, wait. We haven't presented the argument yet, so don't poison the well before we drink.
Okay, right. I don't buy the argument, but the first reason I don't buy it is this number two. Okay, let's...
No, we haven't got to number two yet. We're still just defining our terms.
Well, wait a minute. You're saying, let's do this then. Let's forget the number. Let's say what you just said, the idea of possible worlds. To me, that's kind of a bogus concept, or at least it's one I don't have enough IQ to get. Okay. You said there's a world in which Hillary Clinton is president of the United States. Yeah, there is. I would call that Wonderland, like Alice in Wonderland. That's a fantasy world. That is not a real world.
Right.
So
I agree.
When you say in some possible, if something possibly exists, first of all, you said it's not given that it exists. It's only a possibility that it exists. So if a possible proposition such as that exists in some possible world, well, yeah, but that world is perhaps a fantasy world, so what good is it? So, I mean, it's just something, you know, we could all imagine a world where anything could happen. We could have giant bunnies and the 100-foot Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, anything we want. But as long as it's possible, how does that relate to truth? And that is not, you said this is a description of reality. That's no description of reality. There is no reality in which Hillary Clinton is president of the United States.
Okay. I largely agree with what you say, Bob. These other worlds, you can call it Alice in Wonderland world or fantasy world or anything like that. That's fine. All these are just maximal descriptions of the way reality might be. Not the way the reality is. We've already said the actual world is described by this set of propositions. But those propositions are not necessarily true. Those propositions could have been false. And if they were, you would have another description of the way the world would be. Now wait, let me respond to your point. That doesn't mean that just anything could be. As I said, it's impossible that the prime minister be a prime number. There's no possible world in which that's true. There's no possible world in which there are married bachelors or in which there are round triangles and things of those sorts. So this idea of possibility and necessity is definitely an important idea, especially when we're trying to sort out nonsense from what is meaningful. Very often people will assert self-contradictions, and they need to be told that isn't even possible. There's no possible world, for example, in which God is evil, in which God creates people that go through unremitting suffering and never have a chance to experience good. That's an impossibility. So there is no possible world like that.
Okay, one other thing, and I won't belabor it. The phrase reality might be. Reality is, and there is no conditionals. There are no conditions to reality. When you say reality might be, you're having a conditional voice there. Reality is, and it's one thin little set, and then everything else is not reality.
Yes, that's right. But there is this idea here, Bob, that I think we need to get a handle on, of what's called modality. And modality is what is concerned with possibility and necessity. And you're right, whatever is real, or whatever is real is, that's the way things are de facto. But not everything that is necessarily. Things could be different. And not everything you can just imagine in your mind is really possible. There are some ways reality could not have been. Self-contradictions, for example. So we're asking questions here not just about the way things are, but about the way things could have been or the way things might be. And that is really significant. I think this idea of the modes of existence is very important, whether something is possible, whether it's impossible, whether it's necessary, whether it's contingent. These are, I think, important questions to ask. And intelligible. Okay, some other question. Yes, Claire?
Maybe just a simple layman's way of saying this is this is the reality today, but things could change. And then tomorrow we could have a different reality.
Okay, now Claire raises an interesting question, and this is really a knotty problem, and that is how do you introduce time into these worlds? Because things change over time. So P may be true today, like Obama is the president of the United States, but that hasn't always been true, and it won't always be true. So reality itself is changing. And so what you would have to do would be to outfit these propositions with times and dates so that their truth value doesn't change. You would say, Barack Obama is president of the United States in 2010, something like that. And that's always true, if it's ever true. In 40 BC, it's true that Barack Obama is the president in 2010, and it will be true long after he's dead and gone. So we're talking here not just about the way the world changes over time. You're quite right that the world does change over time. But we're talking here about the way things might have been but never will be. For example, God might never have created the world. As Christians, that's what we believe. We believe that creation was a free act of God, that it was no compulsion. So there's a possible world in which all of the propositions about the things that we see around us, and they're all false. And what's true in that world is God exists alone. There is no universe. There is no time. There are no people. There is no space. And you would just have propositions about God and what he does and is and so forth. So that's a possible way reality might have been. You see what I mean? We're talking here not just about change over time, but about totally different ways reality might have been. What might have been? That's often the way philosophers define possible worlds. They'll often say, a possible world is just a way things might have been. Now, I like this concept better because it helps you to make it more concrete and to think of a possible world as just a conjunction of all these propositions that describe the way the world is. Okay, some other question.
Is this somewhat related to God and middle knowledge?
It's related, Cindy, in that if you remember our discussion of God's omniscience, we said that God is all-knowing, and so he knows the all possible worlds. Before he creates this world, he knew the range of possibilities that were open to him to create, and he chose which possible world would be the actual world.
And as that affects us, he knows with our free will what we could have chosen, but he also knew what we chose.
I would affirm that, yes, that God, now here we're getting a little off on a tangent, but Cindy is recalling what we talked about when we talked about the attributes of God, that God knows what we could have done had some other world been actual. He knows that I could have been a firefighter, say, or a farmer, or something of that sort, had one of these other worlds been actual. What middle knowledge says is even more radical than that, though, Cindy. What it says is God also knows what I would have done had I been in some other circumstances. Not merely what I could have done, but what I actually would have done. And that's even more radical to suggest that God knows something like that. But that isn't presupposed in what we're talking about here. So you can just leave that to the side. What we're just talking about here is that when people talk about possible worlds, they don't mean, as Bob reminds us, that there are these other mysterious realities out there. These are just imaginary. They are ways the world might have been. Now, Plantinga's argument appeals to the idea of God as a maximally great being. Now, what does Plantinga mean by that? Well, first he talks about what it is to be a maximally excellent being. And Plantinga says a being that is maximally excellent would have such attributes as being omniscient or all-knowing. He would be omnipotent. He would be omnipotent, and he would be perfectly good. So if God is, or if a being is maximally excellent, he'll be omnipotent, omniscient, and omnibenevolent. Now, a maximally great being will be a being which is maximally excellent in all possible worlds. It will be a being which has omnipotence, omniscience, omnibenevolence in every possible world. That is what it means to be maximally great. And that would be the greatest conceivable being, this idea of a maximally great being. Any question about what he means by maximal greatness, then?
Why does he necessarily have to be omnibenevolent?
Well, because to be loving, to be good, is a great-making property. You're greater if you're loving and have this virtue than if you're hateful or even cold or somewhat indifferent. So these are what are called great-making properties. a being which has them is greater than one which doesn't, and therefore a maximally great being would need to have these properties. Lest you think that this material is so difficult to understand that it is of no value whatsoever, I want to share with you a letter that I just got 2 weeks ago from a man in Australia who teaches a Sunday school class of children. And this is what he wrote. Dear Dr. Craig, greetings from Southside International Church in Brisbane, Australia. I would like to express my appreciation for your excellent ministry, which has been very useful to our church. I am a Sunday school teacher with a class of wonderful students, ages 8 to 10 years old. 8 to 10-year-olds. For a while now, I have been teaching, and I have used material from your website to prepare Sunday school lessons in apologetics. Your ministry is helping us to teach them a defense of Christianity. For example, one of the students liked the lesson so much that she went home and shared it with her non-Christian father. He previously had thought Christianity was silly, but after reading her worksheet, he said, that actually makes sense. I have found the students to be so intelligent that they were taught the cosmological, moral, teleological, and even ontological arguments. Not only did they find the lessons enjoyable, most of them even seemed to understand it. I have attached a copy of their Sunday school worksheet so that you can see for yourself. And then he includes these worksheets. God is using your work to help these children become strong in the faith. With God's grace, they will grow up to become mature, intelligent, and active Christians through your work. Perhaps some of them will even decide to be an apologist like yourself when they're older. All of us at Southside International Church again say thank you for the work that you do. Sincerely, Joseph Tong. And then the children sign it. Thomas Wu, David Wu, Howard Wong, Ansing Huang, Yanni Gi, Celine Zhang, Banka Zhang, Jenny Zhang. And here's the Sunday school worksheet that these children work on, the ontological argument. And it starts off talking about how to understand the word possible. It's possible. He differentiates possibility of knowledge and possibility of existence. And he says what possibility of existence means is what could exist or what could be real. For example, I could have been fat. Me being very fat is possible. I could have had five sisters. Me having five sisters is possible. I could have been a prince or a princess. Me being a prince is possible. And you can see from the doodles that children, you know, have filled in all of these worksheets on the ontological argument with incredible depth of understanding about these notions of maximal excellence, maximal greatness, possibility, and so forth. So I get really impatient with adults who depreciate themselves, you know, and say, I'm too stupid to understand this. Nonsense. You are not too stupid to understand this. This is stuff that an 8 or 10-year-old can get, and you can get it too. So, you know, I was thinking that too. If it weren't all scribbled on, filled out, I think I should write to Joseph Tong and ask him to send these worksheets, because it occurred to me that the advantage that these children may have is that he probably explains it better than I do so that they're getting it. But anyway, that's a real encouragement, I think, to all of us to see that this material really is graspable. So is there any question that anyone would ask about this before we launch into the argument proper about the idea of possible worlds and what it means to be maximally great? Okay, James.
I believe this is related, but what I'm trying to understand is if there are certain attributes that he does have, are certain attributes from a maximally great being, then does it follow that God is under certain obligations because of that?
I don't think that follows from this, James. Again, these are further questions that one could ask. For example, you might say, is a being who is omnibenevolent morally obligated to do certain things or not? And that will raise really difficult questions. When I talked about the moral argument for God's existence, and when we talked about the goodness of God, when we looked at the attributes of God, I don't think that God has any moral obligations myself, because I think that moral obligations stem from God's commands. Our moral duties are constituted by his commands, and he doesn't issue commands to himself, so he doesn't have any moral obligations. Does that mean, therefore, that God can just do anything? That he could create a world, say, in which children are tortured unremittingly with no hope of escape? Well, no, because that would be incompatible with his character, with his omnibenevolence. It's not that he has a moral obligation to do something, but it's just that he's too good for some of those things to be possible. So I would say that's an impossible situation. There's no possible world in which children are unremittingly tortured with no means of escape.
Well, if I could follow up, I mean, I'm specifically in certain passages in the Bible, he does obligate himself. I mean, for example, you know, in Genesis, where he swears by himself that he's, you know, when he promises yes. Abraham what he's going to do, that once he does that, he actually does seem to me like he does obligate himself to do certain things.
Well, that would be a matter of God's making a promise. And again, what one would say is that God is faithful and therefore keeps his promises. But he's not under any sort of obligation to make that promise. But again, here we're starting to go off on a tangent that is interesting and important, but it's not really relevant to the argument that we're considering right now. What we want to make sure we understand now is, do we understand the idea of different possible worlds, different ways reality might have been, and do we understand what it means to be maximally great, which is to be maximally excellent in every possible world? Susie?
I don't know if this matters, but your question made me think, the omnibenevolence, is that not based on our idea of what is good, a societal type of thing? I mean, because in some societies, they would go with the omnipotent and omniscient, but being good would not be part of it.
Yeah.
He may be a strong, mighty warrior or something would be more valuable.
Yes, I think that that's open to discussion. We'd have to talk about that, I think. What do you think? Do you think being loving is a great-making property? And it's not clear that all the attributes that are normally ascribed to God are great-making properties. For example, take the question of God's eternity. Is it greater to be timeless than to be everlasting throughout time? Well, I don't think we have any clear sort of sense of that. Some people think, oh, it's greater to be outside of time, that the greatest conceivable being must be timeless because he would transcend time. But other people would say, no, it's greater to be active and dynamic and interacting with things, and therefore it's greater to be temporal, but to be everlasting throughout time. And there I think we just don't have any real clear sense of which is the greater way. Maybe they're neutral, maybe they're 50-50 or something of that sort. But with regard to other properties, I think we can say that it's clearly better. For example, morally, it's better to be morally loving and kind and generous, or at least, if you don't like omnibenevolence, replace that with moral perfection, that God must be a morally perfect being, as well as omnipotent and omniscient. Yes?
Two things. I think omnibenevolent is an assumption, but it rests on objective moral values really exist, which you've already addressed.
Yes.
And the other thing is, knowing and they're being possible, they're two different things. Knowing possible worlds in two things. And to me, I think you can go from this argument that the maximally great God exists to imply that he is a God of the maximally great reality, which is not perceived now and everybody struggles with evil, but It actually is.
All right, well, hang on to those thoughts. Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to go somewhere else with them, but you're quite right about there's a difference between knowing something is possible and it's really being possible, and we'll pick that up again later. Any other question so far? Anybody who hasn't asked a question yet first? Okay, let's come back to Claire then again.
Well, I can see where this, in my own, I can see where this characteristic of benevolence can, you know, be the tripping point, so to speak, because some people might say, how in the world can you say this God was maximally benevolent when he told the, you know, the Israelites to just wipe out certain nations, that type of thing? And then the other thing is, in more recent history, how can you say he was benevolent when he allowed the Holocaust to take place and didn't intervene to stop it?
Okay, that really wouldn't be relevant to this argument, Claire, because all that would show is that the Christian God isn't the true God, that the God of the Bible isn't the real God. The real God is this maximally great being which has been distorted by the Christian religion or something of that sort. So we're not arguing here for the God of the Bible. We're arguing here for the notion of the greatest conceivable being. Now, if you don't like that notion of omnibenevolence, let's just substitute morally perfect for that.
No, I do like it. I think he is, but those are questions that I think people have. Like,
right. Though those questions aren't relevant to this argument. Those are relevant to whether or not the God of the Bible is maximally great. And that will be discussed when we get to things like the problem of evil and suffering and things of that sort. All right, now with those concepts in mind, here's Plantinga's argument on your handout. Number one, premise one, it is possible that a maximally great being, otherwise known as God, exists. It's possible that a maximally great being exists. Two, if it is possible that a maximally great being exists, then a maximally great being exists in some possible world. That's just what it means to be possible. Take the question after we're done. That's just what it means to be possible, is that something exists in some possible world. Three, if a maximally great being exists in some possible world, then it exists in every possible world. Why? Because that's the way maximal greatness is defined. Maximally great means you have maximal excellence in every possible world. So if a maximally great being exists in some possible world, it exists in all of them. Four, if a maximally great being exists in every possible world, then it exists in the actual world. Remember, we said earlier that the actual world is one of those possible worlds. Namely, it's the one that's actual. So if he exists in every possible world, he exists in the actual world. Five, if a maximally great being exists in the actual world, then a maximally great being exists, because the actual world is the world that exists or is real. Six, therefore, a maximally great being exists. Now, before we entertain any critical comments on this argument, let me just ask, are there any comprehension type questions about the argument? Yes, Ted.
But just a little lost.
All right.
Okay, but first off, number one, it says it is possible that a maximally great being exists. Okay, I go along possibly. But in the second one, it looks like they should say then a maximally great being does exist. You're saying it does exist. Is that correct?
No.
Notice
what it says. It says it exists in some possible world.
Okay, but it does exist in some possible world.
Right.
Okay, I'm lost, but I don't understand why, if it's possibly exist in some possible world, why it then does exist. Just because it's possible, what makes it do? What makes it happen?
It's because that's what we defined possibly true to mean. Remember I said, when we say that something is possibly true, like Hillary Clinton is the president of the United States, that just means there is a possible description of reality that could be true that has that proposition as part of the description. So don't think of existence in a possible world as some sort of mysterious form of existing somewhere. It just means that that proposition is true in one of these descriptions of the way the world could be.
To me, it seems like this whole argument really rests on number three. And I don't at the moment see why three follows. I think I could buy something similar to three, which would say, if a maximally great being exists in some possible world, and if that possible world is the actual world, then it exists in every possible world. But as stated, I don't see why three follows.
Okay, the reason three follows is by the definition of maximal greatness. Maximal greatness means that it exists in every possible world. So if in some world there is a being which is maximally great, then that means that that being exists in all of the worlds. Otherwise, it wouldn't be true that it is maximally great. So imagine some other world, say W10. In W10, imagine there's a maximally great being. That means that in W10, if you look out at all the other worlds, that being is in all those other worlds too. So the very definition of maximal greatness means that if it's in one, it's in all. So the controversial premise is not actually three. The really controversial premise is one. That's the controversial premise. Kyle.
Okay, so I used to have trouble with this, and now I think I understand it. So let me phrase it my way, and you can tell me if I understand this correctly. The reason why three fall is because if there was a possible world where there is a being possessing qualities like omnipotence, omnibenevolence, etc., or whatever, but this being only existed in one possible world, for example, and not every possible world, then that would not be a maximally great being. It would only be one possibility. So if we say there is one that possesses these qualities in one possible world, that we could say is a great being. If
excellent, an excellent, maximally
in,
excellent, you
in
could
three
say.
Worlds or something, that's a greater being. And if you have one that exists in every possible world, then that's maximally great.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Kyle has got the idea. So imagine that these are possible worlds, okay? And let's imagine that in one of them, there is a maximally great being. Well, as Kyle said, to be maximally great means he has maximal excellence in every possible world. So that means it must exist in all of them. So it's either all or nothing. If the being is maximally great, he can't just exist in one world or it wouldn't be maximally great. The definition entails that it must be in all of them.
Am I correct in saying that a maximally great being is equivalent to a necessary being?
Yes. So, well, not equivalent. It entails his necessary existence. But he's not just necessary. He's also omnipotent, omniscient, morally perfect,
okay,
and all the rest. But right, it would imply it has necessary existence.
And so a maximally great being, in a sense, can't not exist if it's...
Right.
Okay.
See, that's what Anselm said, is that once you understand the concept of God, you can see that God can't not exist. That's what the atheist is going to have to say, is that premise one is false. That's right. So what we want to talk about next time is what warrant exists for premise one. In fact, let me wrap up by saying that contrary to expectation, steps 2 to 6 of this argument are really uncontroversial. Steps 2 to 6 just follow by definition. What is really controversial is premise one. Is it possible that God exists? And so what we'll want to do next time is look at what warrant exists for thinking that the existence of God is possible.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.